Thank you. The recording has started. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, on today's UDRP drafting team call on Wednesday, the 13th of April. On today's call, we have Carlos Aguirre, John Berard, David Taylor, and from staff, we have Margie Milam and myself, Marika Konings. We have apologies from Jeff Newman and Mary Wong. Over to you, Margie.
Thank you, Marika. Well, it looks like we don't have very many people on the call today. I guess the best thing to do at this point is to just go over the agenda and see if anyone has any changes. And then, oh, good, Christina's joined the call. And then we might, if we don't have very many people on the call, talk about giving people time to comment on the questionnaire before we send it out, since I just sent that out. So with that, I've set up in the Adobe Connect room the questionnaire on the status of the UDRP, and I apologize for sending it out so late. David Taylor and John and I worked on it yesterday, and what we to do really was gather information that could be available from the UDRP providers. And we did draft an introduction to the UDRP questionnaire that kind of sets the framework for the questions. And with that, I guess I'll just open up the queue and see if anyone has any comments on the questionnaire. It looks like Christina's on the call as well. Carlos?
Yes, thank you. I accept your apologies with respect to the later send of the questionnaire, but in my case, it's not enough because I'm not English speaker, and I need more time to review and analyze this question. But I accept your apologies. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Carlos. How much time would you think would be fair to give people an opportunity to make comments on the questionnaire?
I don't know, but I received the questionnaire 20 minutes ago.
That's right. That's correct. Would today's Wednesday, would the end week suffice if I gave everyone till Friday to comment on it?
Yes, maybe. Probably.
Okay.
That works fine for me. I'll probably give it some more thought because we did put it together quite rushed, so it's nice to actually sit there and read it through again and figure out some more things. I've got some queries on the questions already.
It's not War and Peace, though, right? Okay. Friday's great.
This is Christina. I'm sorry, Adobe. I'm having my usual issue with the Cisco security preventing me from getting into Adobe.
Christina, it's not Cisco security. It's your firewall.
No, because I have to turn off the security and the default. It's a long story. Trust me. It's part of that. In any event, I had two questions, actually more than that. First, it would seem to me that the answer to one, I don't know that we need answers to both 1C and 1I, because to the extent that we are saying that a default judgment is one in which the respondent does not respond, and I think we need to identify what we mean there. But if that's what we're saying, then we could get the answer by subtracting, 1C from 1A. So I'm just trying to get a sense as to what we're trying to get at with 1I that we wouldn't otherwise get.
This is John. Is the process not one in which the the lack of response is confirmed. So if there is no...
There's no default judgment. It's not a there's no response, you win. There's always a decision.
Okay.
So if you all were trying to get at the number of proceedings in which there was no response by the respondent, it would seem that that's already covered.
Yeah, Christine, I'd agree with you on that one because I think if the I was in there on Margie's draft and I went and added in the C, that's two of us drafting, but I agree, I think it's defunct because, there's, as you rightly say, there's no default judgments complainants that has to make out his case. So we'd get that from A and C, so I would have probably said that I can just drop. I don't know what anyone else thinks, but we get that from, say, A and C.
And I guess the other question I have is that do we have reason to believe that these are questions that the providers can answer? And I'm asking in particular with regard to 1H, because I don't know to what extent the providers track that.
I guess on a year-by-year basis, because I do know that we're obviously seeing a larger increase year-on-year. I believe WIPO do track it, but I don't know whether that's, you know, completely something which they could go ahead with and have those statistics. I think they could probably dig it out, as anyone could dig it out on all the published decisions. So that's one which I imagine would take them a little bit more time. They won't have that to hand. I think
it's probably worth checking with NAF to see and CAC to see whether they track this as well, because I'm not sure it makes any sense to ask a question that only, you know, one of the four providers can answer.
But, I mean, I don't know. I see what you mean. I'd have thought it seems to me a really good question to ask.
Oh, it's a great question to ask. I just don't know if they actually track it.
Through and look at all of the cases published and see whether there's a proxy in there and come out with the results. So CAC, given the number of UDRPs they've got, that wouldn't take too long. WIPO would take a heck of a long time, and NAF sort of in the middle, et cetera. So it's certainly something which they can find out, and I'd have thought it's something which, even if they got back to us later, it would be a very useful fact to have. I mean, maybe they won't reply to it. Maybe we wouldn't get an answer, but maybe we would, which would be quite useful, I think.
It just seems to me that we're better off just reaching out to them informally, and you know, we can do that through members of the group, or if people aren't comfortable with that, have Margie do it, to find out whether they actually track that. And if they don't, would it be possible for them to compile that information, and how long would it take? I don't want to put them in a spot where we ask them a question that they either can't answer or they can answer, but it's going to take somebody 50 or 60 hours to go through decisions. I don't think that is helpful.
Christina, it's Margie, if I may respond. I was thinking of this as I drafted this to solicit information if it's available, and maybe I need to maybe a clarification in the introduction is appropriate, because I just don't have any sense for what information they have at their fingertips, and
okay.
I didn't expect them to do, you know, massive research for this. This is very, very preliminary, you know, a brainstorming kind of effort as opposed to a real, you know, survey that would be done if a PDP was conducted. So that was kind of how I looked at this. I was trying to imagine the kind of information they might have readily available, and if they don't, they would just simply reply, you know, not available or something, or, you know,
okay.
they could do what they want. But to the extent that there is any data, I thought it'd just be useful to have some, just at least a preliminary idea as to the, you know,
And this is just the partial questions, because weren't we also going to ask them about identifying providers or panelists, or is that going to be done separately?
I assume that would be separate as part of the invitation to the webinar.
Okay.
I was thinking of this purely a factual thing that if they could provide that information quickly, that would be great. But yes, that's certainly part of the discussion and part of what I had in mind.
Okay.
My question, if I can go back to you, you suggested that we drop one of either one C or one.
I think one I should probably be dropped simply because there is no such thing as a default judgment.
Okay, great. That's what I'll do. Is there any objection to doing that? I think I came up with that question. Just want to make sure no one objects to dropping one I.
I'm absolutely fine with that.
Okay. And right before the call, Jeff Newman provided some quick comments, and I have posted them on Adobe Connect. Is there, if you can see them, essentially he had a question regarding the introduction that was proposed, thinking that the questions were loaded. And so I don't know if, David, you, I think that was your change, if you'd like to reply to that or...
I posted that quickly to the list as well, following that, because, yeah, it's lifted straight from the RAP working group report. So that was just, you know, to beef up that introductory paragraph. So it seemed fine, and I didn't feel it was loaded, but maybe we need to think about it. But as I say, it's directly the same wording now.
This is Wendy. I'm sorry to jump back to the earlier question about default. Is there a way to... if default isn't the right word to use there, I think we still want to know about questions A and B, how many result in a decision where there is a respondent and where there is not a respondent. One could imagine a case being dropped even without a response coming in through the UDRP process or a case being decided adversely to the complainant, even though there was no response. I think it would be interesting to learn whether that happens and with what frequency.
Yeah, I mean, if David here, yeah, if we can't elicit that from sort of subtracting any of the A's and C's questions, then yeah, we could put a specific one in. I agree, it's interesting. And I know WIPO tracked that of the number of transfers based on the number of replies, etc. So they've got all those sort of statistics. We could certainly ask that. If you can catch a phrase or phrase that the way you want to, then stick something like that in definitely.
Wendy, do you have a suggestion for the wording?
Maybe it's just an A sub or result in a decision. I'll play with it offline and send something.
Okay. Any other comments on the questionnaire?
I mean, the one thing that I'm just wondering how to deal with it is that, with the exception of the language question, most of the questions don't deal with some of the process issues that have been raised with the UDRP in terms of locking and you know, transfers during the course or registrars not transferring or whatnot. And I wasn't sure to what extent we wanted to cover that in this.
I thought we were trying to initially get a quantitative set of database, and then we could move to the qualitative.
So you're anticipating two surveys, two questionnaires, John?
Well, I mean, this questionnaire is going to be a part of one of the planks that we build the webinar on.
Right.
And my assumption is that webinar, as we prepare that, we will use it to address some of those more subjective aspects of the
I don't think it's subjective. I mean, I'm talking about issues where, you know, there are issues with transfer, issues with locking in the names. Those aren't really subjective. It either happens or it doesn't. You know, I'm not putting a value judgment on it. I'm just saying, you know, to what extent the providers have encountered issues that wouldn't really go to the substance of the UDRP in terms of what the criteria are, what the defenses are, you know, that type of thing.
No, as long as we could expect that they can put a number to the that they can answer the question with a number or
right. No, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, and that's certainly what I had in mind.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because you know those are certainly considered by some to be kind of inefficiencies in the process.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we do get into this, you know, please provide your opinion on whether the definition of cyber squatting ought to be reviewed or updated. please highlight any insufficiencies, inequalities you see with the process. And those are far more open-ended than maybe they should be. And let me think about that. Maybe I might ultimately recommend that we not include number 5 in this survey.
John, if I may comment, this is Margie.
Hey, Margie.
I included those because I was really tracking the language of the GNSO Council resolution, and that's essentially what it's asking, the issue report to address. Now, obviously, I can write whatever I, come up with, or staff can write, in the issue report. But I just thought it'd be interesting to get their perspective on that, which is why I included those questions.
No, and that's why I didn't, that's why I thought they were okay in the review prior to the session. But, now I have 2 more days to fiddle.
Okay. Yeah, that's, does anyone else have concerns about the open-endedness of those questions?
I quite like them being open-ended because we might get some interesting material back, which we think, we should have asked that question, perhaps. So,
or more likely, we'll get, my God, it's going to take us a long time to answer that question. Can we have an extension?
Yeah.
And I guess the one question I have in terms of having them complete it is what I think we should try and stay away from, or encourage the person's the providers that are submitting responses to stay away from, is I don't think it's particularly helpful if they answer a question by saying, please see the following letters, or the following reports, simply because that can get very time consuming. So I guess the question is that for purposes of the actual instructions on providing answers, to what extent do we want to discourage? I guess, Margie, this question is really for you, because I would imagine you're the one who's going to have to tabulate the responses. But, to what extent do you want to discourage the responses from just cross-referencing other documents?
I think probably the only place I would think it's okay is answer to number 6, where I specifically ask them for information or documents. But, it is a difficult to thumb through a large document to understand what they're, what point they're trying to make. So that would be very helpful. And I can certainly clarify that in the instructions. Christina, to get back to your point about the transfers I think transfers are expiration issues.
I was just using it as an example. There's basically no process questions on here.
Yeah, that's right. And in the presentation that I gave to the council early on, there were a number of process issues. I just wasn't sure how far to go with this questionnaire. Would you like me to make some suggestions and post them to the list, or do you have any particular?
I don't have any particular ones in mind. I think that would be really helpful. And maybe for those, it's the question should be kind of a check the box, as opposed to how many instances of. In other words, in your experience as a provider, have any of the items below, or however you want to phrase it, occurred? And then if they want to provide additional comments, they can. But I think at a certain point, it might not be particularly reasonable for us to expect everybody to have very kind of hard data at their fingertips on some of this stuff. I could be totally wrong, but.
Okay. I'll try to come up with something and circulate it to the list. Any other comments on the questionnaire? Okay, hearing none, I guess we'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which is the proposed webinar date and format. It did take us a bit longer to get this questionnaire out, And so I guess the question first for you all is how much time do you think is reasonable to ask, to allow the providers to provide this information? I think, David, you probably have a good idea, having worked with some of the providers.
Yeah, well, I've suggested on our little drafting group by email, I said I thought we should do at least 3 weeks, and I thought, 4 weeks would probably be more reasonable, but I'm open to anything. I'd have thought 3 weeks needs to be in case people are away for a two-week holiday and holidays in May, et cetera. Open to any discussion on that.
Well, what are the dates that we should work backward from?
Assuming that we want to have this a lot of this information available for the webinar, today's the 13th. I was thinking of hosting the webinar the week of May 3rd through 5th or the week after that. I wouldn't want it to be any later than the week after that.
Are you saying the week of May 9th or the 30th
of
May?
I wouldn't want it to be any later than early in the week of May 9th, and preferably the first week of May to give me enough time to, take the information and finalize the draft issue report.
So, in other words, if we can get this out, if we can get it sent out on Friday of this week or Monday of next, we'd basically be giving them 3 weeks.
And I think it's doable. I certainly think we can get this questionnaire turned around and sent out either Friday or Monday. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it seems doable to me.
Okay. So I'm going to try to shoot for setting up the webinar Thursday of the week of May 3rd. Let me look at the calendar.
12th of May.
No, the week before that.
Oh, okay.
Oh. I thought you said you were going for the week of the 9th of May.
Well, I could. It's just if I'm going to do it that week, then I want it earlier in the week so that I have sufficient time to turn things around. Marika, do you remember when is the publication date for Singapore? I forgot off the top of my head.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think it's the 30th of May.
Oh, okay. Then I can go as far. If it's the 30th of May, I can go as far as that week, the week of May 9th. Does that seem like a preferable date to you all on the call?
Well, I think so. If we're going to give them 3 weeks, if it goes out on Friday, then that gives them to the Friday the 6th of May, which would mean you'd have all the information in to be able to have that information the following week. So that seems to me to be workable. If we're doing it the week before, in effect, giving them the two in a bit weeks, which just if you're asking meaningful questions and we actually want a little bit of input from them, for instance, reverse domain name hijacking, I'm not aware that WIPO actually has a list and a full list of all the cases which have involved reverse domain name hijacking. So someone's going to go in and search their database, I would have thought, and look for it. So they do have to put a bit of work in, and obviously the more work they put in, the better data we get.
That's right. Okay, so let's shoot for May 12th then.
I actually think that date is going to be a problem because you have the INTA annual meeting starting the 14th and the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition annual meeting starting the 11th. So you basically have the whole trademark community out of pocket from May 11th through 20th. So if you want to do it the week of May 9th, it would have to be the 10th at the latest, I think.
Okay. Okay, you think 10th is doable?
Well, now that's really a question for the, the review of the data and logistics of the thing. But I think it sounds like it's doable. It sounds like we need to do it then.
Because otherwise you can't do it until probably the 23rd, and I don't know that gives you enough time margin.
No, I don't want to push it that long, honestly. With all the other things we have to publish for the meeting, I may have other things on my plate that also need to get done that week. So I think May 10th is fine, and I'll send to the list kind of a next step and let everyone know that that's the date I'm looking for.
Sounds good.
Okay. With regard to the format of the webinar, I just wanted to touch base on and confirm what we talked about last week, because I know that there was some chatter on the email list regarding the format of the webinar. And so, as you guys recall, we were talking about 90 minutes, giving each provider 5 minutes to address how to make the UP more efficient and to discuss and rank their top issues for improvements. And then we were going to ask them to recommend 2 panelists each so that we could select some a few speakers for about 20 minutes to discuss their issues. And then we also indicated that we would ask the provider to recommend 2 attorneys, one that regularly represents complainants and the other one that regularly represents respondents, so that we could pick some speakers that would speak for about 20 minutes on the on their topics. And then the rest of the webinar would be for audience input. And so I know that that the speaker list seemed to get some concerns on the email list. And I think, Wendy, you may have had some comment on that. Is there any, you know, update to that or any suggestions on how to change the format?
Yeah, my thought was it would be great to get a bit more diversity of participants, unrepresented respondents and non-repeat players might have very different views of the process as well, and getting sort of a what does it look like the first time you're faced with one of these might be interesting, as well as the what does it look like once you've done 50 of them. And then I thought there are academics who have done studies of the UDRP and have done some statistical analyses and other review who also might contribute.
I actually think Wendy raises a good question that we might want to add to the survey is in, you know, in what number of proceedings has the respondent not been represented by counsel? Again, that might be information they don't have or information that, I mean, they do have, but that it would be time-consuming to get. But I think it's probably an important data point.
Okay. I will add that to the list.
That you begin to see how this can be parsed. I mean, what if the respondent is a lawyer?
Really, John? Are you serious?
At some point you have to sort of draw a line and say, you know, do a...
Right, but if one of the concerns that we've heard historically from the non-commercial stakeholder group is that, you know, there's a concern about how a respondent who's not represented, who's not kind of regularly represented by counsel, in other words, an individual, you know, how they deal with these when they get them and why notice periods have to be a certain length because they've got to go out and hire counsel and the like, I think we need to know, you know, how big is this issue that we're actually talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, you know, I would be shocked if there are any proceedings. The only person I can think of would be Ari Goldberger, like way back in the day, but I don't think that was even a UDRP. I think that was actual federal court litigation over the Esquire ESQWIRE. I don't know. I mean, you know, we can ask, but I do think that we need to, you know, we hear repeatedly about, you know, these individual respondents who don't have counsel, and I think it's important to know, you know,
how often that actually happens. Okay, that's fair.
No, I agree completely. I think that's a great question to ask because it is good to know.
And frankly, I think the even better question is how often do they win? Because, you know, I would have to think if there's that to me would be really interesting to find out. But, you know, that's more of kind of an esoteric interesting as opposed to helpful
now
in the future.
Now we're in the area of legal.
Right,
now we're
exactly.
In the area of legal.
No, you're right.
So let me ask a question to Wendy. How would we identify the folks that you think might be useful to bring that other perspective?
Well, the academics, I think we can find with a review of the literature. I'm not sure whether we ask the providers or simply look at the database or simply put out a call through our networks or from ICANN for people who have thoughts from other perspectives on this process. Now, I recognize that some of that will come in public comment afterwards and elsewhere, but it would be great to include that perspective in this discussion.
I think that could, when we were going through this, we'd sort of divided it into three sections, the providers, the panelists, and then the complainants and respondents' attorneys. Perhaps we should just have a fourth section there, which is complainants and respondents, which would probably be the most interesting part of the webinar. Because then there's the real-life stories.
Yeah, but how do you figure out who?
Yeah, difficult.
I mean,
maybe there's a way of getting to
years.
You know, if it's a 20-minute session on that, and you've got at least two from each, maybe three from each, and we have to start reaching out by the webinar. I mean, put a call out on the ICANN.
Right. I mean, I recognize that it's difficult, but I worry about the perspective otherwise that we get only the institutional participants and even the repeat responder attorneys have an institutional perspective of they've seen this lots of times before that is different from the attorney who gets a first call from somebody bringing one of these to him or the person who gets a complaint and doesn't even know whom to contact.
Wendy, just so I'm clear, what's the information that you think we can elicit from, for example, you know, an individual one-time respondent that would help us? That we
what was confusing to them? What was unexpected? Did it work? Were you satisfied that it was fair, whether you won or lost in the end?
Well, I don't know. Personally, I think it's probably not any less confusing than the domain name registration agreement that they had to agree to, but that's just me. If we can find people we all agree on, I think that'll be great. I just think it's going to be hard to find somebody that, you know, and frankly, you know, if we find the ideal candidate, it sounds like might be somebody who got one for the first time, wasn't represented by counsel, tried to handle it themselves, and lost. I'm just wondering whether somebody like that is going to want to go on a webinar and talk about it. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, there might be somebody out there.
Then that may point to the limitations of the webinar for fact gathering. And
absolutely, and I think I don't think any of us think that speaking for myself, I certainly don't think that the webinar is going to be an exhaustive fact-gathering mechanism. But given the resources and the time, it seems to be a good one.
Hopefully we'll get a lot of these comments in on the public, you know, comment period. That's where that'll reach out, and people will be putting in their personal comments, as we always see. And I agree with Christine. I think that sort of person may not at all want to participate in a webinar. I can certainly identify quite a few people who've received cases who afterwards we've ended up chatting, and, you know, they really are not cyber squatters. So, again, it really depends what sort of person you can get, because you can find somebody who's not a cyber squatter, but they did it really in error, and I genuinely believe they did it in error, and what they thought of the process, because they thought they were going off to court. And that they were going to be sued, etc. They really didn't understand what was going on. They were still infringing, but that sort of person would have a very different story to, you know, another person who is a cyber squatter and maybe just did it once. And some of those stories would be, I mean, they're the users of the whole system, so it would be good to have them in if we can identify them. And if we can't, at least we've reached out to try.
So, David, to follow up on your suggestion, is this something we could ask the providers to identify a respondent that didn't appear to be represented by counsel and lost contact? I don't know. I'm just, you know, trying to figure out.
I wouldn't want it to be sort of accused that the providers are slanting it in their favor. I know the providers do have a lot of contact with registrants, the ones who threaten to come to Geneva and blow them up, for instance. So, you know, you can find all those people, and hopefully we can get somebody who they think is, going to provide some useful information. But I agree. I think, with Wendy, if Wendy reaches out, we reach out. And we just see whether we can get some appropriate people. And they just may not be appropriate. But, I mean, we could certainly ask providers as well if they're aware of anybody. It's a difficult question to ask. And in the same way of complainants, I suppose it's users of your system who, again, how do you ask it? Have you got users of the UDRP system which are happy or unhappy? Because I'm sure you've got a lot of complainants who think it's rubbish and just don't use it and will always want to go to court. So do you get one of those in as well as a complainant who loves it and wins lots and lots of cases? I don't know. I mean, that's the difficult part. It's probably why we didn't go into it on the last call of the first three areas we can do. But, I mean, that could be a lively end discussion. Maybe it needs to be case studies. Maybe we need to say we'd like to have four case studies, two complainants, two respondents in your case studies, and we'd love to hear from you and see who comes forward.
Sure, and this is Margie. One way of getting information could be looking through those, those domain wire and domain blog sites, where whenever there is a decision that seems to go astray, you'll often see someone blogging about how unfair it was, or writing an article about it. I can certainly do some research and make some suggestions in that regard. Does that seem useful?
I think so.
I just think we need to make sure that the call for participants gets out wide enough. And I'm not quite sure how to do that. But, hey, I know. ICANN's working on the new GTLD communications program. Maybe they've got some ideas. Sorry.
And the other thing, Christina, is, we can't have, the end of the webinar dedicated to, questions from the audience. So certainly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think we absolutely should make sure that we've got questions. I mean, time for questions.
And so long as there's been, hopefully a decent dissemination of the announcement, you get people that would, share their views. With regard to the academics, what do you suggest, Wendy, for identifying, a few academics to speak?
I think Lexis or Westlaw search of law reviews and on the subject would pull up.
Okay. I can certainly do that and make suggestions to the list.
Thanks.
Well, Margie, on that, I mean, which section would we try and bring academics in? Is that creating a fifth section then, where we've got an academic discussion on it as well? Because that seems to be... I know I'm not quite following that, really. We've got the providers, because this is the idea, is to get the facts and figures out there. So are we having a debate amongst academics? Lots of different academics. I'm not quite following. I think maybe you should have an academic view if you want one academic view. But again, it's sort of the same. You bring that in with the providers and have one person there, or do you don't really see how that fits more users of the system, I'd have thought, unless they've filed cases on their, you know, also acting for it or have had cases brought against them.
Yeah, the question is, do we want another category or do we want to lump them in with the section that deals with complainants, respondents, and academics? I guess it could be, you know, part of that. It's up to you guys as to whether you think that's appropriate or not.
This is Wendy, and I was thinking that getting lots of numbers dumped out, it would be useful also to have some analysis of those and what are the oddities or quirks in those statistics. So I guess I would see academic analysis as a separate category.
But the academics, Wendy, won't have access to the data until well after, I mean, you know, if you look at our timeline, it would be something that, you know, they wouldn't even have access to really analyze it before the webinar. So I'm not sure that that could work. You know, they certainly could be invited if we look ahead to the Singapore meeting, for example, and if we schedule some sort of workshop in Singapore on the UDRP. You know, I could see, you know, a possible role there. But in terms of responding to the data that comes from the providers, I'm not sure that, you know, they would have any time to do real analysis.
Right. So some of them have analyzed, thinking more of those who have analyzed the material already, done earlier sets of data from decision databases or the providers. I think it would also be interesting and separately to ask for or even commission some analysis of the data that we get back, you know, in this call.
So you're suggesting an analysis, commissioning analysis before a PDP starts? Because, I mean, I can see that, you know, that's obviously useful. If we actually launch the PDP. But this is, in essence, kind of, you know, before that process where we're identifying issues and you know, and preparing the report so that the council can vote.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily thinking about timing. I'm simply thinking I think it would be useful to have multiple perspectives in the webinar, the institutional participants and some from elsewhere in the system looking in at it. And that's the perspective I think that academics and infrequent participants can help provide.
Any other comments on Wendy's proposal, whether it should be a separate category or part of, you know, one of the existing categories?
I've thought maybe we could have that. And so it was nice if we got three sessions and we were saying 20 minutes each. That was an hour, and then we were thinking half an hour for discussion. If we've got another session of 20 minutes, which are the complainants and respondents themselves, the actual, I suppose, users, maybe we could have that section, I mean, have somebody in there. I don't know, that's been one or two people in that section, so otherwise it's going to go on way too long. If we have it a two-hour webinar, we can't go further than 2 hours. On that fourth group which we've created, we maybe have a... again, I'm trying to think. So you've got complainants, respondents, and observers. That opens up the observers to academics. I don't know, just thinking out loud here completely. And then maybe if we don't have anybody as complainants and users actually wanting to talk in the webinar, then we covered on the observers who do want to comment, and that fills it up nicely. Because that then would be what would be on 1 hour, 20 minutes total. And I think we should probably leave at least 20, 30 minutes for discussion, if not through to the 2 hours. Questions from the audience. Which is probably where we'll pick up the users, because when these people who are watching this webinar will may well be the users who wouldn't step up to be in the webinar, but are quite likely to tell their stories, you know, their horror stories or whatever in the actual webinar and the questions.
I like that approach. I think at this point you do probably have to expand it to 2 hours. I don't think it's too bad to have a two-hour webinar, especially on a topic as important as the UDRP. So, I like your approach. I think that would make sense, and then it would pick up the ability to have the academics. Does anyone oppose that approach?
I'm sorry, dropping the academics, I would still...
I'm sorry, Wendy, I don't mean to interrupt. Just to clarify, it would be a two-hour session. The academics would be part of the complainants, respondents, and observers category.
That sounds plausible. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, I'll put that in the email to send to the list. Before we close off on the questionnaire, Carlos had a suggestion in the chat. I don't know if you all had a chance to look at it. Carlos, would you like to explain? You had a suggestion for a question to be included.
Yes. I agree with Wendy's idea to add the academics in the webinar, because if we want to have all perspectives, we need to add all points of view on this discussion. I think particularly that if all the UDLP process questioning now, but it's a particular position. I would like to ask the participants of the webinar or workshop or here if there are another option to UDRP. I feel that it's possible to imagine another solution to the cybersecurity.
Carlos, if you got a solution that's faster and cheaper, I'm all for it. What is it?
URS.
No, I'm serious. I mean, if there are other solutions, I think you'd hear from, resoundingly from the trademark community that, if there are solutions that, will keep the same balances in check and have results more quickly and at less expense to them, I think they'd be supportive of it.
So does anyone suggest that regard, or is it something that's out of scope given the the UDRP is the focus of the issue report?
I think it's interesting, but it does feel a little bit out of scope. If these characters had a better idea, wouldn't they have offered it or suggested it or floated it? And what kind of trouble do we roil if we begin asking about alternatives to the UDRP?
Well, I'm going to hide under my desk. So.
Well, you're protected by that significant firewall that you have.
That's true.
I think we have to focus on the UDRP, but I think at the end of the day, are we sitting there saying different ways of tweaking the UDRP? I mean, that's in effect what's happened, where we see the EUDRP with WIPO, and we also see where the supplemental rules, you know, are changing. We've got different sets of supplemental rules over the place. That's the UDRP adapting, rightly or wrongly. But, I mean, I think we probably have to focus on the UDRP, because, again, if we talk about, imagine other things, we wouldn't really want to open up a discussion on the URS here. And if we do open a discussion on the URS, then I think a lot of people would say, well, yes, let's wait and see what the URS does and get stats on that, and then we can use that to look at the UDRP, which in many ways is sensible. So I think, I don't know, I think we'd have to focus on the UDRP. Or you'll have a lot of brand owners saying that, you know, as long as there's the equivalent legislation as in the US, then yes, we wouldn't need to use the UDRP, and there isn't that across the world. So then we could end up in a discussion of court litigation across the world and which jurisdictions you can do what in and get damages for, and I just think we'd probably get inundated and lost. I don't know, Wendy, what do you think on that, on your side?
I think it sounds as though we have enough on our plate with the current challenges, but could be an interesting question to include.
I mean, I think one of the hardest things for me on looking at this is, you know, when we see an injustice, if we do see, and there are injustices, but the whole idea of UDRP, you can't actually appeal it. So I think we're actually wrong on the way we say that in the questions, but, you know, you go to court. But there's no obligation on any respondent or complainant who's gone to court to report that back to the provider. So at the end of the day, we don't know how many cases generally go to court, and then how many of those generally find in favour of one of the other parties. And in effect, that's a lovely statistic to be able to have and to be able to look at, because then you really would see. Because again, if 10 cases have all gone to court and just been blocked for a few years, and then ultimately the domain name's been transferred or, you know, whatever, it you know, you just don't know the percentage of the problem, and that's one of the things which I don't think we'll ever know. But hopefully, maybe we can elicit it somehow if we get to PDP status and stage.
I mean, I don't know. I understand your point, David. I just think that given that you have had registrars whose business model to encourage registrations has been a, you know, if a UDRP is filed against you, we will file a legal complaint in the judicial system that takes almost the longest in the world to resolve anything, so you're good for another 10 years. I mean, that, I think, you know, I think you'll find that that has really skewed the number of appeals. But maybe that should be one of the provisions that should be considered is, does the appealing party have to notify the provider, and does the provider have to make those statistics available?
Because in many instances, and we've come across that, we find a case which has been filed, and you know, on the site it says it's been awarded to the complainant, but it isn't, because when you go and check, it's actually being appealed in some court. And the provider isn't even aware of that. Obviously, there's quite a few where they are aware of it. It's a tough one. It's tough to get the statistics and the facts.
But wouldn't a registrar promoting that kind of workaround get kicked out?
You would think.
Has not happened? You mean you've seen the marketing materials and ICANN has stood idly by?
It was presented at an ICANN meeting in Lisbon. In an open session, as, gee, isn't this innovation by our registrar members?
And which is the slowest moving court system on the planet?
Well, it's one of them, and that's India.
Well, it's a big place. So that information is somewhere in a transcript out of the Lisbon meeting.
I can send it to you, John, offline.
That'd be great.
But,
I'd love to
but my point is that I think we just need, the point I was trying to make indirectly is that I think we need to be careful about all of these numbers because there might be factors in them that we may not have a way of kind of taking into account, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and that's just one of them, one example. And, you know, and if you were to filter all of those out, maybe the numbers would be valid. But on the other hand, it's not necessarily fair to automatically filter all of them out. So how do you...
So do I hear a new question regarding that, or is this a debate about the open issues that eventually would take place in the PDP if one?
No, I mean I think that there's an existing question, and I think that would be useful to know.
Do you have a suggestion to that existing question? Because we do have. Are they
No, it's already there. It's already
okay.
There.
Okay.
But kind of getting to my question about, well, you know what, Margie, I'll wait to see your list of kind of process stuff, and then I'll weigh in.
Okay. Okay. I think we're pretty much at time. It sounds like we probably need another call next week. Do you all agree?
I think once we've got everybody's feedback by Friday, we probably should reconvene just to sign off on everything.
Can we do Monday? Is Monday good? I'm thinking of making sure we get it sent out if we do have any slip, so we can try and get the questionnaire out on the Monday.
Right, because then we start running into Easter week closures.
Because I just think, you've got to give a 3-week period to the providers because we're asking some things here which we want to try and get good information back on.
Right, but I guess this is the question, what I don't get is why do we have to have the data before the webinar? I mean, presumably each provider that's going to participate will have their own data. I mean, yeah, it would be great to have it because then we have it and Margie isn't kind of chasing people all over the globe trying to get their data. But having the webinar is not dependent on the providers reporting the data as long as the providers are going to present it in the webinar.
Well, I think if we have the information in advance of the webinar, it allows us to organize it and direct it in a way that makes it more meaningful and maybe come in on the 2-hour time frame. Otherwise, we could wind up creating a lot of tangents that are impossible to tie together. So I think having the data in advance gives us a chance to structure and manage the webinar in a more productive way.
Maybe we can just do it at the beginning. I mean, I agree. I think it focuses the webinar, so I think it would be best if we could do it, but again, we shouldn't be unrealistic and squish it and give people 4 days to provide it. It just makes everyone look silly. But maybe on that, where we kick off at the beginning, we'd appreciate receiving your responses to these questions by XX date, 6th of May, or whatever I think I've put down here. In order.
David, would that be XXX date?
Sorry, I actually did that and I was writing an opinion and I said that. I had to stop myself now because up until now I've been using that and I've got to stop. So. I'd say that responses by this in order to be considered or as part of the webinar, but obviously, any further input would be greatly welcomed after the webinar. It's not, then if somebody can't provide it, they can't provide it.
Okay, I think that's a good idea. I will have Gisela
send. So are we going to get together next Monday or Tuesday at the same time?
Yeah, I'm thinking send a doodle for Monday and Tuesday, but preferably Monday, and that way we'll get it out, finalize it, and approve it on the next call.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
Sounds great.
Great, thank you, everybody.
I'll reply to the doodle.
Have a good week, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Bye.